you were trying." He did not finish. He looked at the three faces before him, and a sudden smile ended his sentence, a smile of weariness, of pity, of incredulous revulsion. He was seeing the final contradiction, the grotesque absurdity at the end of the irrationalist's game. The men in Washington had hoped to hold him by prompting these three to try for the role of hostages. "You think you're so good, don't you?" It was a sudden cry, and it came from Lillian. She had leaped to her feet to bar his exit. Her face was distorted as he had seen it once before on that morning when she had learned the name of his mistress. "You're so good. You're so proud of yourself. Well, I have something to tell you." She looked as if she had not believed until this moment that her game was lost. The sight of her face struck him like a last shred completing a circuit, and in sudden clarity he knew what her game had been and why she had married him. If to choose a person as the constant center of one's concern, as the focus of one's view of life, was to love, he thought, then it was true that she loved him. But if to him love was a celebration of one's self and of existence, then to the self-haters and life-haters, the pursuit of destruction was the only form and equivalent of love. It was for the best of his virtues that Lillian had chosen him, for his strength, his confidence, his pride. She had chosen him as one chooses an object of love, as the symbol of man's living power. But the destruction of that power had been her goal. He saw them as they had been at their first meeting, he the man of violent energy and passionate ambition, the man of achievement, lighted by the flame of his success and flung into the midst of those pretentious ashes who called themselves an intellectual elite, the burned-out remnants of undigested culture, feeding on the afterglow of the minds of others, offering their denial of the mind as their only claim to distinction, and a craving to control the world as their only lust. She, the woman hanger-on of that elite, wearing their shop-worn sneer as her answer to the universe, holding impotence as superiority and emptiness as virtue. He, unaware of their hatred, innocently scornful of their posturing fraud. She, seeing him as the danger to their world, as a threat, as a challenge, as a reproach. The lust that drives others to enslave an empire had become, in her limits, a passion for power over him. She had set out to break him. As if unable to equal his value, she could surpass it by destroying it. As if the measure of his greatness would thus become the measure of hers. As if, he thought with a shudder, as if the vandal who smashed a statue were greater than the artist who had made it. As if the murderer who killed a child were greater than the mother who had given it birth. He remembered her hammering derision of his work, his mills, his metal, his success. He remembered her desire to see him drunk just once, her attempts to push him into infidelity, her pleasure at the thought that he had fallen to the level of some sordid romance, her terror on discovering that the romance had been an attainment, not a degradation. Her line of attack, which he had found so baffling, had been constant and clear. It was his self-esteem she had sought to destroy. Knowing that a man who surrenders his value is at the mercy of anyone's will. It was his moral purity she had struggled to breach. It was his confident rectitude she had wanted to shatter by means of the poison of guilt. As if were he to collapse, his depravity would give her a right to hers. For the same purpose and motive, for the same satisfaction, as others weave complex systems of philosophy to destroy generations, or establish dictatorships to destroy a country. So she, possessing no weapons except femininity, had made it her goal to destroy one man. "Yours was the code of life," he remembered the voice of his lost young teacher. "What then is theirs?"
"I have something to tell you," cried Lillian with the sound of that impotent rage which wishes that words were brass knuckles. "You're so proud of yourself, aren't you? You're so proud of your name, Reardon Steele, Reardon Metal, Reardon Wife. That's what I was, wasn't I? Mrs. Reardon, Mrs. Henry Reardon." The sounds she was making were now a string of cackling gasps, an unrecognizable corruption of laughter. "Well, I think you'd like to know that your wife's been laid by another man. I've been unfaithful to you, do you hear me? I've been unfaithful, not with some great noble lover, but with the scummiest louse. With Jim Taggart, 3 months ago, before your divorce, while I was your wife, while I was still your wife!"
He stood listening like a scientist, studying a subject of no personal relevance whatever. There, he thought, was the final abortion of the creed of collective interdependence, the creed of non-identity, non-property, non-fact, the belief that the moral stature of one is at the mercy of the action of another.
"I've been unfaithful to you, don't you hear me, you stainless Puritan? I've slept with Jim Taggart, you incorruptible hero, don't you hear me? Don't you hear me? Don't you?"
He was looking at her as he would have looked if a strange woman had approached him on the street with a personal confession. A look like the equivalent of the words, "Why tell it to me?" Her voice trailed off. He had not known what the destruction of a person would be like, but he knew that he was seeing the destruction of Lillian. He saw it in the collapse of her face, in the sudden slackening of features, as if there were nothing to hold them together, in the eyes, blind, yet staring, staring inward, filled with that terror which no outer threat can equal. It was not the look of a person losing her mind, but the look of a mind seeing total defeat, and in the same instant, seeing her own nature for the first time. The look of a person seeing that after years of preaching non-existence, she had achieved it. He turned to go. His mother stopped him at the door, seizing his arm. With a look of stubborn bewilderment, with the last of her effort at self-deceit, she moaned in a voice of tearfully petulant reproach, "Are you really incapable of forgiveness?"
"No, mother," he answered. "I'm not. I would have forgiven the past, if today you had urged me to quit and disappear."
There was a cold wind outside, tightening his overcoat about him like an embrace. There was the great fresh sweep of country stretching at the foot of the hill, and the clear receding sky of twilight. Like two sunsets ending the day, the red glow of the sun was a straight, still band in the west, and the breathing red band in the east was the glow of his mills. The feel of the steering wheel under his hands and of the smooth highway streaming past as he sped to New York had an oddly bracing quality. It was a sense of extreme precision and of relaxation together, a sense of action without strain, which seemed inexplicably youthful, until he realized that this was the way he had acted and had expected always to act in his youth. And what he now felt was like the simple, astonished question, why should one ever have to act in any other manner? It seemed to him that the skyline of New York, when it rose before him, had a strangely luminous clarity, though its shapes were veiled by distance, a clarity that did not seem to rest in the object, but felt as if the illumination came from him. He looked at the great city with no tie to any view or usage others had made of it. It was not a city of gangsters or panhandlers or derelicts or whores. It was the greatest industrial achievement in the history of man. Its only meaning was that which it meant to him. There was a personal quality in his sight of it, a quality of possessiveness, and of unhesitant perception, as if he were seeing it for the first time. Or the last. He paused in the silent corridor of the Wayne Falkland, at the door of the suite he was to enter. It took him a long moment's effort to lift his hand and knock. It was the suite that had belonged to Francisco D'Anconia. There were coils of cigarette smoke weaving through the air of the drawing room, among the velvet drapes and bare polished tables. With its costly furniture and the absence of all personal belongings, the room had that air of dreary luxury which pertains to transient occupancy, as dismal as the air of a flophouse. Five figures rose in the fog at his entrance: Wesley Mooch, Eugene Lawson, James Taggart, Dr. Floyd Ferris, and a slim, slouching man who looked like a rat-faced tennis player, and was introduced to him as Tinky Holloway. "All right," said Reardon, cutting off the greetings, the smiles, the offers of drinks, and the comments on the national emergency. "What did you want?"
"We're here as your friends, Mr. Reardon," said Tinky Holloway, "purely as your friends for an informal conversation with a view to closer mutual teamwork. We're anxious to avail ourselves of your outstanding ability," said Lawson, "and your expert advice on the country's industrial problems."
"It's men like you that we need in Washington," said Dr. Ferris. There's no reason why you should have remained an outsider for so long, when your voice is needed at the top level of national leadership.
The sickening thing about it, thought Reardon, was that the speeches were only half lies. The other half, in their tone of hysterical urgency, was the unstated wish to have it somehow be true.
What did you want? He asked.
Why, to listen to you, Mr. Reardon, said Wesley Mooch, the jerk of his features imitating a frightened smile. The smile was faked. The fear was real. We want the benefit of your opinion on the nation's industrial crisis.
I have nothing to say. But, Mr. Reardon, said Dr. Ferris, all we want is a chance to cooperate with you. I've told you once publicly that I don't cooperate at the point of a gun.
Can't we bury the hatchet at a time like this? Said Lawson beseechingly.
The gun? Go ahead. It's you who are holding it. Bury it if you think you can.
That was just a figure of speech, Lawson explained, blinking. I was speaking metaphorically.
I wasn't. Can't we all stand together for the sake of the country in this hour of emergency? Said Dr. Ferris. Can't we disregard our differences of opinion? We're willing to meet you halfway. If there's any aspect of our policy which you oppose, just tell us and we'll issue a directive to... Cut it, boys. I didn't come here to help you pretend that I'm not in the position I'm in, and that any halfway is possible between us. Now come to the point. You've prepared some new gimmick to spring on the steel industry. What is it?
As a matter of fact, said Mooch, we do have a vital question to discuss in regard to the steel industry, but your language, Mr. Reardon.
We don't want to spring anything on you, said Holloway. We asked you here to discuss it with you.
I came here to take orders. Give them.
But, Mr. Reardon, we don't want to look at it that way. We don't want to give you orders. We want your voluntary consent.
Reardon smiled.
I know it.
You do?
Holloway started eagerly. But something about Reardon's smile made him slide into uncertainty.
Well, then.
And you, brother, said Reardon, know that that is the flaw in your game, the fatal flaw that will blast it sky high. Now, do you tell me what clout on my head you're working so hard not to let me notice? Or do I go home?
Oh, no, Mr. Reardon, cried Lawson with a sudden dart of his eyes to his wristwatch. You can't go now. That is, I mean, you wouldn't want to go without hearing what we have to say.
Then let me hear it.
He saw them glancing at one another. Wesley Mooch seemed afraid to address him. Mooch's face assumed an expression of petulant stubbornness, like a signal of command pushing the others forward. Whatever their qualifications to dispose of the fate of the steel industry, they had been brought here to act as Mooch's conversational bodyguards. Reardon wondered about the reason for the presence of James Taggart. Taggart sat in gloomy silence, sullenly sipping a drink, never glancing in his direction.
We have worked out a plan, said Dr. Ferris too cheerfully, which will solve the problems of the steel industry, and which will meet with your full approval as a measure providing for the general welfare while protecting your interests and ensuring your safety. Don't try to tell me what I'm going to think. Give me the facts. It is a plan which is fair, sound, equitable, and don't tell me your evaluation. Give me the facts. It is a plan which...
Dr. Ferris stopped. He had lost the habit of naming facts.
Under this plan, said Wesley Mooch, we will grant the industry a 5% increase in the price of steel.
He paused triumphantly. Reardon said nothing.
Of course some minor adjustments will be necessary, said Holloway airily, leaping into the silence as onto a vacant tennis court. A certain increase in prices will have to be granted to the producers of iron ore, 3% at most, in view of the added hardships which some of them, Mr. Larkin of Minnesota, for instance, will now encounter, inasmuch as they'll have to ship their ore by the costly means of trucks, since Mr. James Taggart has had to sacrifice his Minnesota branch line to the public welfare. And, of course, an increase in freight rates will have to be granted to the country's railroads, let's say 7%, roughly speaking, in view of the absolutely essential need for...
Holloway stopped, like a player emerging from a whirlwind activity, to notice suddenly that no opponent was answering his shots.
But there will be no increase in wages, said Dr. Ferris hastily. An essential point of the plan is that we will grant no increase in wages to the steel workers in spite of their insistent demands. We do wish to be fair to you, Mr. Reardon, and to protect your interests, even at the risk of popular resentment and indignation. Of course, if we expect labor to make a sacrifice, said Lawson, we must show them that management, too, is making certain sacrifices for the sake of the country. The mood of labor in the steel industry is extremely tense at present, Mr. Reardon. It is dangerously explosive, and in order to protect you from, he stopped.
Yes, said Reardon.
From
possible violence, certain measures are necessary, which...
Look, Jim, he turned suddenly to James Taggart, why don't you explain it to Mr. Reardon as a fellow industrialist?
Well, somebody's got to support the railroads, said Taggart, sullenly, not looking at him. The country needs railroads, and somebody's got to help us carry the load. And if we don't get an increase in freight rates...
No, 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 snapped Wesley Mooch. Tell Mr. Reardon about the working of the railroad unification plan.
Well, the plan is a full success, said Taggart lethargically, except for the not fully controllable element of time. It is only a question of time before our unified teamwork puts every railroad in the country back on its feet. The plan, I'm in a position to assure you, would work as successfully for any other industry.
No doubt about that, said Reardon, and turned to Mooch. Why do you ask the stooge to waste my time? What does the railroad unification plan to do with me?
But Mr. Reardon, cried Mooch with desperate cheerfulness, that's the pattern we're to follow. That's what we called you here to discuss.
What?
The steel unification plan.
There was an instant of silence, as of breaths drawn after a plunge. Reardon sat looking at them with a glance that seemed to be a glance of interest.
In view of the critical plight of the steel industry, said Mooch with a sudden rush, as if not to give himself time to know what made him uneasy about the nature of Reardon's glance, and since steel is the most vitally, crucially basic commodity, the foundation of our entire industrial structure, drastic measures must be taken to preserve the country's steelmaking facilities, equipment, and plant.
The tone and impetus of public speaking carried him that far, and no farther.
With this objective in view, our plan is really very simple, said Tinky Holloway, striving to prove it by the gaily bouncing simplicity of his voice. We'll lift all restrictions from the production of steel, and every company will produce all it can according to its ability. But to avoid the waste and danger of dog-eat-dog competition, all the companies will deposit their gross earnings into a common pool, to be known as the Steel Unification Pool, in charge of a special board. At the end of the year, the board will distribute these earnings by totaling the nation's steel output and dividing it by the number of open-hearth furnaces in existence, thus arriving at an average which will be fair to all. And every company will be paid according to its need. The preservation of its furnaces being its basic need, every company will be paid according to the number of furnaces it owns.
He stopped, waited, then added, That's it, Mr. Reardon. And getting no answer, said,
Oh, there's a lot of wrinkles to be ironed out, but that's it.
Whatever reaction they had expected, it was not the one they saw. Reardon leaned back in his chair, his eyes attentive, but fixed on space, as if looking at a not-too-distant distance. Then he asked, with an odd note of quietly impersonal amusement, Will you tell me just one thing, boys? What is it you're counting on? He knew that they understood. He saw in their faces that stubbornly evasive look, which he had once thought to be the look of a liar cheating a victim, but which he now knew to be worse, the look of a man cheating himself of his own consciousness. They did not answer. They remained silent, as if struggling not to make him forget his question, but to make themselves forget that they had heard it.
It's a sound, practical plan, snapped James Taggart unexpectedly, with an angry edge of sudden animation in his voice. It will work. It has to work. We want it to work.
No one answered him.
Mr. Reardon? Said Holloway timidly.
Well, let me see, said Reardon. Orrin Boyle's Associated Steel owns 60 open-hearth furnaces, one-third of them standing idle, and the rest producing an average of 300 tons of steel per furnace per day. I own 20 open-hearth furnaces working at capacity, producing 750 tons of Reardon metal per furnace per day. So we own 80 pooled furnaces with a pooled output of 27,000 tons, which makes an average of 337.5 tons per furnace. Each day of the year, I, producing 15,000 tons, will be paid for 6,750 tons. boil producing 12,000 tons, will be paid for 20,250 tons. Never mind the other members of the pool, they won't change the scale except to bring the average still lower. Most of them doing worse than boil, none of them producing as much as I. Now, how long do you expect me to last under your plan?
There was no answer. Then Lawson cried suddenly, blindly, righteously, "In a time of national peril, it is your duty to serve, suffer, and work for the salvation of the country."
"I don't see why pumping my earnings into Orrin Boyle's pocket is going to save the country."
"You have to make certain sacrifices to the public welfare."
"I don't see why Orrin Boyle is more the public than I am."
"Oh, it's not a question of Mr. Boyle at all. It's much wider than any one person. It's a matter of preserving the country's natural resources, such as factories, and saving the whole of the nation's industrial plant. We cannot permit the ruin of an establishment as vast as Mr. Boyle's. The country needs it."
"I think," said Reardon slowly, "that the country needs me much more than it needs Orrin Boyle."
"But of course," cried Lawson with startled enthusiasm. "The country needs you, Mr. Reardon. You do realize that, don't you?"
But Lawson's avid pleasure at the familiar formula of self-immolation vanished abruptly at the sound of Reardon's voice, a cold, trader's voice answering, "I do."
"It's not Boyle alone who's involved," said Holloway pleadingly. "The country's economy would not be able to stand a major dislocation at the present moment. There are thousands of Boyle's workers, suppliers, and customers. What would happen to them if Associated Steel went bankrupt?"
"What will happen to the thousands of my workers, suppliers, and customers when I go bankrupt?"
"You, Mr. Reardon?"
said Holloway incredulously.
"But you're the richest, safest, and strongest industrialist in the country at this moment."
"What about the moment after next?" How long do you expect me to be able to produce at a loss?"
"Oh, Mr. Reardon, I have complete faith in you."
"To hell with your faith. How do you expect me to do it?"
"You'll manage."
"How?"
There was no answer. "We can't theorize about the future," cried Wesley Mooch, "when there's an immediate national collapse to avoid. We've got to save the country's economy. We've got to do something."
Reardon's imperturbable glance of curiosity drove him to heedlessness.
"If you don't like it, do you have a better solution to offer?"
"Sure," said Reardon easily. "If it's production that you want, then get out of the way. Junk all of your damn regulations. Let Orrin Boyle go broke. Let me buy the plant of Associated Steel, and it will be pouring 1,000 tons a day from every one of its 60 furnaces."
"Oh, but we couldn't," gasped Mooch. "That would be monopoly."
Reardon chuckled. "Okay," he said indifferently. "Then let my mills superintendent buy it. He'll do a better job than Boyle."
"Oh, but that would be letting the strong have an advantage over the weak. We couldn't do that."
"Then don't talk about saving the country's economy."
"All we want is..."
He stopped. "All you want is production, without men who are able to produce, isn't it?"
That's theory. That's just a theoretical extreme. All we want is a temporary adjustment."
"You've been making those temporary adjustments for years. Don't you see that you've run out of time?"
"That's just theory."
His voice trailed off and stopped.
"Well, now, look here," said Holloway cautiously. "It's not as if Mr. Boyle were actually weak. Mr. Boyle is an extremely able man. It's just that he suffered some unfortunate reverses quite beyond his control. He had invested large sums in a public-spirited project to assist the undeveloped peoples of South America. And that copper crash of theirs has dealt him a severe financial blow. So it's only a matter of giving him a chance to recover, a helping hand to bridge the gap, a bit of temporary assistance, nothing more. All we have to do is just equalize the sacrifice. Then everybody will recover and prosper."
"You've been equalizing sacrifice for over 100...
He stopped.
"For thousands of years," said Reardon slowly. "Don't you see that you're at the end of the road?"
"That's just theory,"
snapped Wesley Mooch.
Reardon smiled.
"I know your practice," he said softly. "It's your theory that I'm trying to understand."
He knew that the specific reason behind the plan was Orrin Boyle. He knew that the working of an intricate mechanism operated by pull, threat, pressure, blackmail, a mechanism like an irrational adding machine run amok and throwing up any chance sum at the whim of any moment, had happened to add up to Boyle's pressure upon these men to extort for him this last piece of plunder. He knew also that Boyle was not the cause of it, or the essential to consider, that Boyle was only a chance rider, not the builder of the infernal machine that had destroyed the world, that it was not Boyle who had made it possible, nor any of the men in this room. They, too, were only riders on a machine without a driver. They were trembling hitchhikers who knew that their vehicle was about to crash into its final abyss. And it was not love or fear of Boyle that made them cling to their course and press on toward their end. It was something else. It was some one nameless element which they knew and evaded knowing, something which was neither thought nor hope, something he identified only as a certain look in their faces, a furtive look saying, "I can get away with it." Why, he thought, why do they think they can?
"We can't afford any theories," cried Wesley Mooch. "We've got to act."
"Well, then, I'll offer you another solution. Why don't you take over my mills and be done with it?"
The jolt that shook them was genuine terror.
"Oh, no,"
gasped Mooch.
"We wouldn't think of it," cried Holloway.
"We stand for free enterprise," cried Dr. Ferris.
"We don't want to harm you," cried Lawson.
"We're your friends, Mr. Reardon. Can't we all work together? We're your friends."
There across the room stood a table with a telephone. The same table, most likely, and the same instrument. And suddenly Reardon felt as if he were seeing the convulsed figure of a man bent over that telephone. A man who had then known what he, Reardon, was now beginning to learn. A man fighting to refuse him the same request which he was now refusing to the present tenants of this room. He saw the finish of that fight. A man's tortured face lifted to confront him, and a desperate voice saying steadily, "Mr. Reardon, I swear to you, by the woman I love, that I am your friend." This was the act he had then called treason, and this was the man he had rejected in order to go on serving the men confronting him now. Who then had been the traitor, he thought. He thought it almost without feeling, without right to feel, conscious of nothing but a solemnly reverent clarity. Who had chosen to give its present tenants the means to acquire this room? Whom had he sacrificed? And to whose profit?
"Mr. Reardon," moaned Lawson, "what's the matter?"
He turned his head, saw Lawson's eyes watching him fearfully, and guessed what look Lawson had caught in his face.
"We don't want to seize your mills," cried Mooch.
"We don't want to deprive you of your property," cried Dr. Ferris.
"You don't understand us."
"I'm beginning to."
A year ago, he thought, they would have shot him. 2 years ago, they would have confiscated his property. Generations ago, men of their kind had been able to afford the luxury of murder and expropriation, the safety of pretending to themselves and their victims that material loot was their only objective. But their time was running out, and his fellow victims had gone, gone sooner than any historical schedule had promised, and they, the looters, were now left to face the undisguised reality of their own goal.
"Look, boys," he said wearily, "I know what you want. You want to eat my mills and have them too. And all I want to know is this. What makes you think it's possible?"
"I don't know what you mean," said Mooch, in an injured tone of voice. "We said we didn't want your mills."
"All right, I'll say it more precisely. You want to eat me and have me too. How do you propose to do it?"
"I don't know how you can say that after we've given you every assurance that we consider you of invaluable importance to the country, to the steel industry, to—"
"I believe you. That's what makes the riddle harder. You consider me of invaluable importance to the country. Hell, you consider me of invaluable importance even to your own necks. You sit there trembling because you know that I'm the last one left to save your lives, and you know that time is as short as that. Yet you propose a plan to destroy me, a plan which demands, with an idiot's crudeness, without loopholes, detours, or escape, that I work at a loss, that I work with every ton I pour costing me more than I'll get for it, that I feed the last of my wealth away until we all starve together. That much irrationality is not possible to any man or any looter. For your own sake, never mind the country's or mine. You must be counting on something." "What?"